from coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
I wonder if the world will ever get a group like ABBA that could harmonize like ABBA again. Will the world ever get that again? Probably, but not necessarily while we're here. It's been too long since I had this on. All right, coming up, we're going to have some fun. Harry Helms is the author of over a dozen books, mostly scientific books, technical topics, that kind of thing. His books include Computer Language Reference Guide. Ooh, maybe I can ask him about my big problem. Electronic Circuits Cookbook, all about ham radio, shortwave listening guidebook, and his latest, Inside the Shadow Government. That's quite a leap for Harry or anybody else. He is a former editor for such publications as McGraw-Hill and Academic Press, co-founder of LLH Technology Publishing. Now, he's a full-time writer and publishing consultant. He has written about ham, shortwave, and pirate radio for magazines like Popular Communications and Monitoring Times. In a moment, Harry Helms. Had so much fun with Harry Helms the first time he was on. I mean, after all, you know me in radio, right? Every single aspect of radio, I am in love with it, always have been, monitoring, listening to different things, as many as you can hear, amateur radio, ham radio. Just a blast, folks. And so Harry was a natural for me. We're going to go down some different avenues with Harry tonight. But first, let's catch up. Harry, welcome to, back to the program.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning. I'd like to catch up, Harry, if I could, with sort of the radio side of things before we get in a jump leap into the shadow government topic. So what's new since the last time you were on with regard to radio? Any part of radio, and what's good monitoring, what's hot?
Well, one of the things that we discussed last time, Art, was the Cuban number stations, the stations that broadcast groups of numbers in Spanish in blocks of five.
That's right.
These are known to be communications to agents in the field using what's known as the five, the one-time pad method of decoding numbers, where the groups of numbers will be transmitted. The agent copies them down, subtracts them from another list of numbers, and then decodes the message. Now, this is a system where if you try to decode the message yourself, it's an exercise in frustration. The people at the national security agencies have supercomputers busy at it, and really there's no evidence they're any better than the rest of us, but certainly these transmissions are easy to hear throughout North America, and it's a bit exciting to say, hey, I'm listening to a message sent to an actual spy.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, you'll come across a shortwave frequency, and you'll just hear some young lady, perhaps in with a Spanish accent or not, going 51, 17, 14, 34, 6, just like that, and in groups and groups and groups, and that's spy stuff, huh?
Yes, indeed. The Spanish numbers sound very much like the system used by the telephone company when you reach a discontinued number to spell out the new number.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll hear something like ocho, dos, cuatro, siete, siete, uno, uno, dos, cinco, siete. That's the pacing. Those are the five-digit blocks. Now, you can hear these in North America from about sundown on the East Coast until about sunrise on the East Coast throughout the night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are some frequencies that have been very active over the past couple of months, and so I'll give them for your listeners. And
oh, yes, please do.
First one is 8010 kilohertz.
Got it.
8097 kilohertz.
Got it.
9063 kilohertz.
This is fun to listen to, folks. Go ahead.
9323 kilohertz.
9323.
And 9908 kilohertz.
9908.
These are all in the AM mode of your shortwave receiver.
Really?
And you can, one distinguishing characteristic of these stations, and one that indicates they are probably from Cuba, is that there's a very loud hum on these signals. And if you've listened to the shortwave transmissions from, like, Radio Havana, Cuba, you also hear that same distinct hum from older transmitters that have not been well maintained over the years.
And I suppose the local, let me try and get rid of this echo. I've got a little bit of echo here. I suppose also the fact that the local Cuban power supplies, kind of like the Russians in the old days, probably aren't that good.
True, and also since the collapse of the Soviet bloc in the Soviet Union, those spare parts are hard to come by in Cuba.
Indeed. In fact, I guess the Cubans are still driving around a lot of old American vehicles, cars, you know, from the 50s and the 40s and the 30s. I mean, you see really old vehicles in Cuba.
True. But these spy transmissions have long fascinated me because how often do those of us who sit at home in front of our shortwave radios actually get to match wits with the CIA and the National Security Agency? Well, you get to do that with this.
Well, make your best case. I mean, the world has changed. To some degree, ham radio is threatened by the arrival of the Internet and the computer. If you were to try to make your best case, Harry, about why people should still listen to shortwave and why it's still fun to listen to shortwave, what would you say?
Two things. One is that shortwave radio is... Is simplicity is a virtue, because when everything else fails, when the internet is down through denial of service attacks or too many users trying to access a certain dialect number, shortwave still gets through.
Well said.
That is it's the safety net for people who want to have access to the world.
And it does give you that, doesn't it? Access to the world.
And at a remarkably low price compared to, say, a computer and internet, a high-speed dial-up connection.
Well, that's right.
The second thing is that for those of us who like a sense of adventure, trying to find these new stations or these unusual stations, like these number stations or pirate radio stations, it's a bit like fishing. So the nights you turn on the radio, you turn around, you hear nothing new or unusual. Some nights you hear something that's quite surprising. It's that element of unpredictability that I think makes shortwave radio monitoring so compelling.
Harry, how do you really feel about the pirates? I mean, these are people, after all, that are breaking the law, right?
That cannot be denied, and I certainly would not advocate that someone go out and operate a pirate station, because there are some substantial penalties if you do get caught.
Like $10,000 a day, and they'll take your equipment, and all kinds of bad stuff can happen to you.
Multiple bad things.
Multiple bad things, yeah. But people, I guess, do it anyway, and that puts it up there to be listened to, right?
There's no restrictions whatsoever on listening to these communications or even attempting to contact the operators.
If I were to listen to pirate radio, what kind of stuff would I likely hear?
Much of it, many pirate stations are operated by young people, so you'll hear the things that are dear to young people's hearts, such as rock, hip-hop music. Much of the programming is, frankly, rather amateurish from production value, even though it can be surprisingly funny. It's often scatological in parts. But it's certainly, I think, considerably different from anything you'll hear on the AM or FM bands.
Well, I got a hot-button question for you. If you had a station like the one you were just talking about playing hip-hop, I mean, obviously, from the FCC's point of view, it's a kid out there messing around.
Yeah.
So you take that pirate station. Then let's consider a second pirate station, one in which somebody's a political activist and they don't like, let's say, the Bush administration. And so they're actively on the air every night transmitting their hate toward the Bush administration. Which one of those pirate stations do you suppose the FCC would pursue?
Frankly, the FCC has shown a greater tendency in the past to go after overtly political stations. There have been stations in the past operated by the Ku Klux Klan, by white supremacists. These have been busted over the ordinary run-of-the-mill pirate stations.
Do you think internally they've got a policy that perhaps is a little lenient when they know it's a kid playing around out there?
I think it's a policy of allocating their resources on how much attention the station is attracting. An overtly political or quasi-clandestine station, if you will attract more attention and perhaps make more of an impact in news media, maybe will have more people complaining about, whereas the station just playing music and other programming aimed at young people, well, that's no big deal. So I think it's just simply a matter of the squeakiest wheel getting the most grease.
All right, then let's try this one, Harry. The reason that the majority of these kids put a pirate station on the air is because they love radio, and they're looking for any way at all to get into radio, to experience what it's like to broadcast. I know gazillions of people like this, Harry, because of what I do. They come to me all the time, and I was there myself. I was almost born on radio. I mean,
right.
I just plain love every aspect of it, and so that's what makes these pirates do what they do. Do you think, Harry, that we should have some avenue, some way, and I guess you could say CB or ham radio's a way, and certainly they are, but I mean something else, some way that young people could legally do some small-scale operation? Should there be something?
We are critically overdue for that, Art, in my opinion. Critically overdue.
Well, what would you set up, Harry?
There are several ranges. For example, let's say just above the expanded AM broadcast band from about 1700 to 1750.
Yes.
That's an area, and you tune across at night, and it's essentially dead.
Yes.
I could see, for example, authorizing low-power stations, say no more than 50 watts or so, into a limited antenna, maybe a quarter wave, in that range, for a non-commercial broadcasting. There's also a little bit of leeway above and below the FM band that could be used, like, say, down from 87 to 88, perhaps. There are also a possibility with television going through all digital and new channel allocations for some frequency space to be, freed up there. So something that would be basically the broadcasting equivalent of CB radio, low power, short range, but with few restrictions and low cost equipment. I think that is something not just for kids, but for every person who wants to go on the air and express an opinion. There's certainly
I've been an advocate of this for I don't know how long. Low power radio and low power television were both proposed and to some degree were passed, but large lobbyists kind of squashed the low-power radio business, so it's groups, you know, churches and that sort of thing, which is fine, but nothing for individuals, really, right?
That's true. The low-power FM initiative a few years ago was indeed adopted by FCC, but the technical standards the FCC imposed on these stations basically put just the administrative overhead of complying with the technical standards beyond the reach of the average person. It takes, as you said, some sort of a church-based or community-based broadcaster to be able to afford a low-power FM station.
Do you think that the... Now, of course, go back, Harry, to when the Federal Communications Commission took the 11-meter band away from the hams and they gave it to the CBers. A gigantic, incredible, monstrous mistake. In every way you can imagine. I mean, 27 megahertz is not a local communications frequency most of the time. It's skip. It's a mess. It's become just a sort of a bad land of people who are now encroaching on the 10-meter ham band. I mean, it's a disaster up there. And I've got CB because it'll save your butt on the road. But it was a disaster. It could have been put up in VHF or somewhere else. So what do you think about that? I mean, you know, when you're proposing a little space above the broadcast band, is that going to turn into another CB band?
Freedom always carries with it some risk, Art, and, including that people will be misbehaving to a degree. But then that's part of the price tag for freedom. It's interesting that free speech applies to, say, if you want to do something in writing, you don't have to get government permission. If you want to publish a book, you don't need government permission. If you want to put up a website, you don't need government permission. But if you want to send something out on the airwaves, which theoretically belong to all the people of the United States, then you have to get the government's permission. And I think that we've been a bit too restrictive over the average citizen's access to the airwaves with their own transmit equipment over the years. Yes, we need some standards, but the way it is now, we have restrictions and no standards whatsoever.
So you're sort of admitting then there would be, with space at the top of the broadcast band, maybe either side of the FM band, whatever, there would be trouble as a result of it, but you're saying that's part of the price of freedom.
Freedom is not always orderly nor neat. There's going to be always a certain messiness with any sort of freedom. The thing is, the benefits of freedom outweigh, I think, the downsides of people abusing those privileges.
Y'all, that's a good answer. Do you think any such proposal has a chance of really making it through, Harry?
In all honesty, I would be extremely dubious. I think perhaps something that would be, maybe we could get the power limit for FM raised from 100 milliwatts to maybe 1 watt or something of that nature. But I think at this stage, being realistic, I think the odds are quite long that the FCC would do such a thing.
There are mysterious sounds on the shortwave bands. Harry, lately on the 40-meter ham band, there has been a 100 kilohertz wide sound. I don't know if you... Did you ever hear me play that on the air?
Yes, I did.
You did. Do you have any thoughts at all about that that signal? It was so interesting because after I brought it up, it had been there for months and months. I brought it up, and it disappeared.
That tends to happen when you
call
query
attention.
The FCC about it, and you have some sort of media connection that could publicize it or write about it. I've had similar experiences. I think what you heard, Art, was probably a variation of the over-the-horizon radar system, which uses the ionosphere, sends a radio signal up there, refracts off the ionosphere, hits the ocean surface, it echoes back up to the ionosphere, and it is received at a location near the transmitting site. And this can be used to track such things as small ocean vessels, submarines that have briefly surfaced, things like that, which cannot be readily tracked by satellites or ground-based radar.
Right. Exactly correct, Harry. I think that's what it was myself, and the majority of opinion after I played it on the air was that it was that. So you're with the strong majority on that, Harry.
And we also have people up in Alaska with HARP doing all sorts of interesting things with our ionosphere.
But yes, we talked about HARP last night, and I'd wager you probably heard the program.
Yes, indeed.
How do you feel about HARP? Knowing as much as you do about radio and what it can and can't do, you're very knowledgeable, and you got to hear the program on HARP last night. What do you think?
My pet theory is that HARP is actually some sort of weapons-related project intended to disrupt or disturb shortwave communications, particularly the guidance systems of missiles, by pumping so much energy into the ionosphere that it becomes highly absorptive of all radio signals, thereby disrupting shortwave communications, or perhaps playing tricks with the guidance systems of missiles that would be coming in over the North Pole.
Wow. That's pretty heavy stuff. No question about it. So you think that... all right, well then, I have one more radio-related question for you, and it's a doozy. Are you familiar with BPL, Harry? Do you know what that stands for?
Oh, yes. Broadband over power lines.
Broadband over power lines. Now, there is this scheme, folks. It's really interesting to turn all of the power lines in America, I mean all of the power lines in America, into delivery systems for the Internet so that we could deliver broadband to every home in the United States. Isn't that right, Harry?
Along with generating a good bit of radio interference in the process.
Yes, well, I was going to get to that part right after the break, and that's what we're going to do. We're at the break point. Harry Helms is my guest. He knows about radio, and we will address the BPL, broadband over the power lines issue, in a moment. And then... Boomba, indeed. We'll talk about the shadow government.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
There is this incredible thing called broadband over the power lines, or BPL, that most Americans probably weren't even aware of. And there's been this intense, gigantic fight going on
between those of us who used the radio spectrum and people who saw dollar signs in their eyes. It would have been a national tragedy. I'll tell you all about it, so will Harry, in a moment. One more time, broadband over the power lines, BPL, a monstrous controversy going on, and here's why. Because power companies and internet providers and, oh, I tell you, they just saw dollar signs like you would not believe. And the idea was to transfer the internet over power lines. You know, the ones going out in front of your house? Those long lines that really are antennas. I mean, they're unshielded wires that carry electricity. And, well, they thought, well, we could carry the internet, too. And there's just one little hitch in that idea. And that hitch, of course, is that it would produce noise. It would wipe out the shortwave band. It would wipe out ham radio. It would wipe out CB. It would wipe out international broadcasters. It would wipe out, well, you know who it'd wipe out? It'd wipe out FEMA. The Federal Emergency Management Agency. And they just filed against BPL, and so a lot of people are going, whew, looks like we may have dodged a bullet, because the last I heard, FEMA said, look, our stuff won't work if you go ahead with this idea. Do you think BPL's going to be dead because of that?
I certainly hope so, Art, because in addition to the shortwave bands, if anyone is out there listening to Coast AM on an AM broadcast band station,
Thank you.
BPL will also do a number on that.
That's right.
Listeners may have noticed in the past when they're out in their car listening to AM radio and they pass their power line, that loud buzz.
And it gets real noisy as you go near the power line. Yeah.
Now imagine that buzz not being restricted to near a power line, but virtually anywhere in the United States, and you hear that noise 24/7. So unless you're within a very short radius of an AM broadcast station, if BPL were implemented, you wouldn't be able to hear it. It would be, for all intents and purposes, the effective end of AM radio reception outside of a few miles of the transmitter.
That's right. And so much more, Harry, would have been interfered with, effectively dead. And it looked like the FCC was in favor of BPL.
That is one of the more incomprehensible stances the FCC's come up with in recent years. I mean,
unless, here's what I thought, Harry, unless the FCC knew in the end it was going to get killed, and they sort of went along with some people just to say, hey, we gave it the college try. I mean, that's all I can imagine.
There's certainly that, and the other part is, you know, many of the people in the FCC making decisions regarding technical matters are lawyers, MBAs, and other people without an adequate technical background.
Yes.
Now, the other thing about BPL that was puzzling to me is that, yes, those power lines are good radiators of signal, but the internet is two-way. You have to send material messages into the internet, into those power lines. That is a hacker's dream.
Yeah, that's right. It really is a hacker's dream, isn't it?
It's almost as if the FCC was saying, okay, we're going to make it easier for hackers to hack into your dial-up internet connection. And that's what BPL would have been. You would probably have widespread hijacking of email addresses, of great theft of internet service.
Yes.
So I saw it not just as dangerous for radio listeners and other users of the radio spectrum, such as police, fire, and emergency services. It would have been a nightmare for users of the internet via BPL, who would suddenly find that their web site or their email address had been hijacked and used by other people.
It almost really would have been over for, you know, monitoring and, it would have been over. I mean, it would have potentially killed shortwave. It's incredible.
Also look at the impact upon military communications.
That's what FEMA essentially was saying. The military is yet to chime in, I think, but surely they will. Hopefully this is deader than a doornail.
I certainly hope so, simply because it would not just been bad for us who are interested in radio, the radio hobby or radio listening. It would have been bad for average consumers, including internet users.
All right. Having said all this, let's now take the giant leap, Harry. You have just written a book, and I first of all, I guess I'd like to know, how do you get from being interested in, you know, in radio and monitoring, which is kind of a technical thing, to writing a book about the shadow government?
It came about, Art, years ago when I first visited a site along the eastern Sierra of California called Manzanar, which was the site of a relocation camp for Japanese Americans during World War II.
Oh, yes.
I have had an interest in ghost towns and archaeological sites, and suddenly I saw what appeared to be a couple of Japanese pagodas against the Sierra Nevada mountains. Checking it out, I got into the history of the place and found out about the several thousand Japanese Americans who were relocated there during World War II. And as I got into the history, determined that these people were American citizens. Most of them were American citizens. None of them were charged with espionage or any other crime, nor were they ever convicted of a crime. They were kept there for the duration by a direct order of the president, not an act of Congress. And they were basically held as prisoners in their own country. Mm-hmm. And I started to say, how is this possible? And as I dug deeper into it, I discovered that the mechanisms, the tools that allowed President Roosevelt to order people on the basis of a race to be held on a military camp indefinitely, those tools were still in place, still valid, could still be used by an American president, and in fact had been greatly expanded over the years. The term shadow government is not original with me. This came from a May 2002 article in the Washington Post.
Let's try this. Define for me what you mean when you say shadow government. What, define it.
The shadow government is the collection of laws, court decisions, facilities, procedures, and tools by which the president, upon declaration of a state of national emergency, could basically circumvent constitutional government and impose his will directly through a device known as an executive order.
You know, I understand the fear, Harry, attached to that. Honestly, I do. And I have some of it myself. But we have to have something like that. Awful as it sounds, there has to be a contingency, does there not? Particularly in the days in which, you know, people drive airplanes into buildings and things like that. There has to be a way to continue, to govern, to get the word out, to have civilization, no matter what might happen. Don't we need that?
We need, indeed, some standby contingency plans. However, the point of my book is that these plans have gone far beyond prudent, rational safeguards for the event of a sudden nuclear attack. They have become so expansive and so open to misuse that it's where these powers could actually be a greater threat to our long-term liberties and constitutional rights than the external threats. For example, I used the phrase, this happens when the president declares a state of a national emergency. Well, what constitutes a state of national emergency? Simply put, whatever the president feels is a state of national emergency. You might remember, 1971, President Nixon declared a state of national emergency, and he froze wages and prices for several weeks.
Yes, he did.
Now, where in the Constitution does it say that he has that ability? And it so happens that he said that the unstable U.S. balance of payments constituted a national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the president, when he declares the state of national emergency, that determination, that state, remains in effect for 6 months before Congress can overturn it. So what would constitute a state of national emergency? That he might lose a re-election campaign?
Okay.
That he might be impeached.
Yeah, no, that's getting down to the meat of it. Is it your contention? And there were rumors, for example, that President Nixon was going to do something like you're talking about right now, instead of leaving office, that he was going to declare some kind of state of emergency and suspend the Constitution, and we were suddenly going to not be a democracy anymore. Those rumors were out there. Actually, you know what? Those rumors have been out there, frankly, for every president, I think, since I've been alive, you know, that was somebody would soon do this.
Well, we do know that in the final days of the Nixon administration, his chief of staff, General Alexander Haig, had all communications and written directives coming out of the president's office passed by his desk first. And he imposed that only in the last few weeks of the Nixon administration. He never said why he did it, but it is widely assumed that he was worried that President Nixon would try exactly what you described here.
You believe he was worried about that? There are some who think that Alexander Haig actually had plans of his own along those lines, which you obviously believe the first.
I tend to believe the first, but certainly that the second cannot be ruled out.
Yeah, most people believe the second. I mean, they all remember the moment when he stood up and said, well, I'm in charge here at the White House, or whatever it was he said. Something
maybe
like
it was
that.
A Freudian slip.
Well, maybe. You think these powers have now been put in place to the point where a president with evil intent could, in fact, turn us overnight from a democracy into a dictatorship?
As I point out in my book, I include in a very lengthy appendix the complete text of several of these presidential executive orders,
yes.
The most sweeping of which were signed and introduced during the Nixon and Clinton administrations. When the president declares the state of national emergency now, for whatever reason, he can do, like President Roosevelt did in World War II, detain indefinitely any group of Americans for whatever reason he sees fit, without filing charges, without legal proceedings, without legal representation. Mm-hmm. In other words, you'd be no better off than the Al-Qaeda prisoners at Guantanamo right
mm-hmm.
now. He can seize private property, including your auto, your home, your computer, furniture, whatever. He can order you to work at specified jobs. He can seize your bank accounts. He can seize control of all radio and TV stations. He can control access to food and medical supplies.
Boy, that's a lot to even begin to tackle here, but I'll stop you at radio and television. As a matter of interest, Harry, how do you imagine an administration would seize control of all broadcasting?
I would think that first you would go to the major networks and broadcasting concerns, the major broadcasting media groups, and do that.
Well, what I mean is there some great master switch that they can throw and take control of virtually everything?
No great master switch, but they would send out orders and saying, here's where you're going to get your program via this line feed, and that's the line feed you would use if you wanted to stay on the air. If you refuse to comply, some soldiers could come down and they could seize it.
Huh. Just imagining such a world is outlandish, Harry.
Well,
I own a little radio station here in Prump, right?
Mm-hmm.
KNYN. And to imagine that somebody would order me to take a certain feed or else is so far beyond what I know and feel as an American that I can't even imagine it.
That's the main reaction when people have when the subject of shadow government comes up, because it sounds so inherently preposterous that you say this cannot be.
Yes.
If I told you on September 10th, 2001, however, that a group of young Arab males armed with nothing more than box cutter knives would, in less than 24 hours, kill over 3,000 Americans and basically destroy two major landmarks in Washington, New York. Mm. Would you believe that?
No.
Right. And it's the things that are most unthinkable that sometimes we have to think about in order to prevent.
Okay. That makes me jump over on the other side. The fact of the matter is, we now know all too well that kind of thing can happen. So again, you know, these things that are so extreme that you're talking about, they are terribly extreme. How do you prepare to fight something like that, or even worse, without having this kind of stuff in place? I think you agree, some of it has to be in place. So how do you shepherd all this? How do you have oversight?
you know, to protect freedom, we don't have to trash the Constitution. What I do propose in my book is that we simply develop openly a system, a methodology in the Constitution by which we will handle catastrophic events. For example, a nuclear strike, terrorist event, or something else that, for example, would remove everyone in the presidential line of succession. Let's put in Constitution how we would reconstitute and restore our constitutional democratic government.
So you're talking about an actual constitutional amendment here, right?
Yes, indeed.
And it would outline it for me.
Yes, indeed. And once people knew what would be done, how it would be handled, I think you would have far greater acceptance of it than some of these sub rosa things which are hidden under the
table. Okay, that's scary. I agree. Go ahead and outline the kind of change constitutionally you would see. I mean, what roughly would it say?
It could be something such as this. If everyone in the presidential line of succession were killed, the governors or surviving governors of the states would then elect a replacement president to serve out the remainder of the term or some other specified period. The same thing would be that, or we could say that in the event everyone in the presidential line of succession is killed, the governors of states, say maybe an order of population or admission to union, whatever formula you would use, would come up.
Yeah, but you're just addressing secession now.
Yes, indeed.
But that doesn't tell me what safeguards and powers you would have to place in the hands of that ultimately elected person to deal with a potential emergency.
There are already plenty of national emergency powers on the books which are known and open.
Well, right, but according to you, too many.
Too many, and also too many without the accountability of the people. At least here in the Constitution, we'd have accountability to the people, to the state legislatures, to the state governors, and to the people who elect them. What has happened now is that there has been a cleavage between power and the accountability at this level. And this is the thing that disturbs me, because many of these powers are not being used to fight terrorism or ensure domestic security.
Well, let me be devil's advocate, Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Those powers that we're talking about, extreme as they are, are put in place precisely so they can be wielded by, for example, one individual, who, the President of the United States. Why? Because if you had all kinds of oversight and procedural things you would have to go through, you'd never get anything done. And if you were, or at least not fast enough, and if you were facing an immediate emergency somewhere along the line, somebody's got to act real quickly, and bureaucracies and committees don't do that.
You need that, but also I think you need closer definition, for example, of what would constitute a national emergency. Right now, it's up to the whim of the president.
How about somebody planting a big, dirty bomb in one of our cities and notifying us, or a big, real bomb, whatever, you know, something awful about to hit us? That would kind of qualify as a state of national emergency,
it
right?
It certainly would, but as I point out in the book, since 1933, for all but 9 months of history, the United States has been operating under one or more presidentially declared states of national emergency. Now, that's a little bit too broad. Sure, we've had some legitimate national emergencies and matters of grave crisis during those times, but certainly not every single month, but 9 since 1933, has been a moment of national emergency.
Hold it right there. Oh, boy. Headaches, indeed. Nothing but heartaches, in fact.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
I'll tell you, folks, think of it as maybe, how about an internment camp for wrong-thinking Americans? Kind of mean a good one. 26 miles across the sea. We're talking about the shadow government, and a lot of times when I talk about the shadow government or I conceive of it, I think of things like that, you know, internment camps, that sort of thing. We'll touch on all of that. Be assured of it. Stay right there. Harry Helms is my guest. Well, Okay, how about it, Harry? Internment camps, is that something, you know, there's always rumors of it. I mean, you hear these internet rumors that pilots have been seeing these sequestered off internment camps waiting for wrong-thinking Americans who are going to be on the wrong side of an executive order, that kind of thing. You've heard about all that, right?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I think many of these reports got their start back in 1984 when the news first came out of something called REX 84, or Readiness Exercise 84.
I remember that.
This was an exercise conducted in the Reagan White House, headed up by Colonel Oliver North, which was to simulate what would happen if there would be a revolution in Central America, sending a great number of people north of the border, illegally north of the border, and what would we do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And REX 84 was a plan to house several hundreds of thousands of these people on military camps in temporary housing. These would not be the formal wood structures, but tents and temporary structures of that nature at all large military camps.
So you're telling me this was not originally for wrong-thinking Americans, politically disagreeable people, to be tossed into?
Not originally, but of course, you can house a right-thinking or a wrong-thinking person just as easily. This is one that came to light during the Iran-Contra hearings in 1987. That's where it first came to light about REX 84.
Was that, if I remember during the Iran-Contra hearings, was that sort of briefly brought up and then squashed real quick?
Yes, indeed. That came up during an exchange between Oliver North and Representative Jack Brooks of Texas.
Do you remember exactly what Ollie North said or something close?
Ollie North did not even get a chance to ask the question. Senator Brooks first broached to Colonel North asking if he had taken part in a plan known as Readiness Exercise 84.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Brendan Sullivan, who was Colonel North's attorney, immediately said, Mr. Chairman, we're in, that's classified, and Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii then informed Representative Brooks that that could not be discussed in open forum.
That's right. That's right. I remember now. That's right. So where do we stand with that? Is that still...
That would still be the basic blueprint for housing large numbers of people in the event it was considered necessary. You might remember during the Clinton administration, many refugees were brought over from Bosnia and temporarily housed on military camps.
Okay, I want to play devil's advocate again. Let's say that Harry Helms is president, and let's say that the big news of the day is that there's about to be a bloody, bloody revolution in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And that unrest has become out of control in Mexico. I'm not saying all this is going to happen. I'm just saying, let's say that's the news of the day. And the possibility is that let's make it millions of Mexicans would flee such a bloody civil war and come across the border. Now, Mr. President Helms, we know that's what we're facing. We don't have enough troops, nor can we simply mow people down on the border as they try to flee a war, Mr. President. So what do we do?
I think we could do a much more effective job of sealing the border than your question presupposes.
Oh, you do?
Yes, indeed. Particularly when you're talking about people who would be arriving largely on foot through open territory. Now, we could shut down major highways and such, but there'd be ways of...
Well, I guess what I'm asking, Mr. President, is would you turn them back to possibly a sure death in the middle of a bloody revolution, or would you accept them across the border?
You might make some limited exception of people, but you would actually have to, if you're going to have a nation, you need to have secure borders. That's the definition of a nation. You can defend your own borders. I think this sort of large-scale housing of several hundreds of thousands would not be in anyone's interest because it would simply encourage more people to come.
Mm-hmm. So you as president then would order some sort of real seal to the border?
Yes, indeed.
even if that meant the taking of life, if necessary?
If it would be necessary to protect American life, I would have no hesitancy.
Uh-huh. Okay. So then you think this whole Rex business is ludicrous and could be used for the wrong thing?
Well, that is the key thing. Again, I don't want to say that we don't need any contingency plans whatsoever.
Right.
Or that we can just simply get by in this world on good intentions. My problem with this is that the definition of what constitutes an emergency, mm-hmm. namely, is defined by the president for whatever reason he sees fit, is far too elastic. And that many of the provisions of these, particularly those that affect the rights and constitutional rights and privileges of American citizens, are far too expansive. For example, the September 11th attacks were not caused by American citizens freely exercising their constitutional rights, and restricting the constitutional rights of citizens would not have prevented those attacks nor future attacks.
Well, that's true.
It is a failure, rather, for the various agencies of the United States to coordinate and share the information they have, such as between the various FBI offices, the Immigration and Naturalization Services, and these other agencies, governments, to properly coordinate and use the available information and to enforce the available laws on the book. We now know, for example, that most of the September 11th hijackers were here illegally. So my point is that rather than this huge secret under-the-table collection of laws, plans, contingencies, what we really need is more effective and focused enforcement of the laws that we already have on the books.
Okay, but Harry, again, playing that devil I do so well, we live in a modern world where we have, the Internet, and all of these very fast, very electronic, very effective means of communication. And those communication channels can be used to plan bad things as well as good. And so I understand, for example, the Fourth Amendment and our rights to privacy. But then again, I also understand our government's need, if they're even going to try and prevent another tragedy in this country, to get hold of, sift through a lot of this information, and that's going to run smack into the Fourth Amendment at 1,000 miles an hour.
I'm wondering, though, how much of this is germane to a task. You are probably aware of a program that was floated briefly last year called the Total Information Awareness Program.
Yes.
A brainchild of Admiral John Poindexter, also of Iran-Contra fame. It was gathered such information as your prescription drug records. It would have gathered such information as which movies you rent from major movie rental outlets.
Books you read at the library.
Yes.
Maybe.
So I'd like to know how, for example, knowing that you have a certain medicine for high blood pressure or that you prefer to watch kung fu flicks, how this ties into preventing terrorism.
Well,
I fail to see the link, and I see the potential for abuse.
Okay, I'm going to have to continue as the devil. It doesn't, Harry, is the answer, and all of that information would be completely useless and irrelevant from the point of view of trying to stop an act of terrorism. However, it may just be that one piece of information, one email sent, one, I don't know, communication, one telephone call, one something could stop another bunch of airplanes from bumping into buildings real hard. And maybe it could, Harry. You can't deny that fact. It might. And so where and how do we draw that line about what our government can and can't listen to in our defense? They are here supposedly for our welfare, safety.
You do what every cop does as part of their investigative procedure, namely, you focus on the likely suspects. Even if the government wanted to, it clearly doesn't have the capacity to monitor all of our phone communications, all of our emails, or all other aspects of our lives. So you have to focus on the people who are most likely to be perpetrators of a certain crime. In this case, as we've now seen September 11th, if the FBI had followed up on credible reports they were getting from flight schools, that there were students from Middle Eastern nations who were interested in learning how to steer planes once they were aloft, G jet airplanes but not interested in learning how to take off or land them, that constitutes a red flag. And that's the sort of thing you should be following up on.
Well, of course, that's also really good 2020, you know, hindsight. But yes, it should certainly create a red flag. But again, that's hindsight. And there's a lot of things in the world you could miss.
Mm-hmm. And the more data you gather from unlikely suspects, the wider the net you cast, then the more data you're going to gather that is extraneous to the thing you are trying to discover, and you just gum up the gears chasing dead ends.
So you wouldn't allow any electronic eavesdropping?
I'd allow it in the same circumstances that we traditionally have allowed it, namely upon a warrant to conduct such a surveillance issued by a court of competent authority. We don't have to protect ourselves by trashing the Constitution. We don't have to destroy democracy in order to save it.
That's the conundrum, all right. And it really does come down to that, to potentially destroying that which we are trying to protect. So, when I first heard about the shadow government, and there are indeed some people who feel this, Harry, I always thought what it was meant by that was a government behind everything we see. A power behind every congressman, every senator, even the president of the United States, a power that's really pulling the strings and orchestrating everything that's happening. And you don't exactly believe that, do you?
I don't see that. What I do see are people who potentially have the power to do certain things in the event of a national emergency who could abuse that power. FEMA is obviously one such candidate. The National Security Agency is another. I see where national security is used and invoked not so much to legitimately protect essential government secrets, but to cover up perhaps mismanagement, wasteful spending, misapplication of funds, and outright failures. This is what I see, and it's not really some master plan that came about when some people got in a secret room and they decide, okay, this is what we're going to do. It came about over years, dating from the National Security Act of 1947, and many seemingly innocuous minor laws that were passed that over time have allowed the enormous accumulation of power and the potential for abuse in one man, namely the President of the United States.
Well, I guess I would ask you now, if you see this giant collection of dangerous possibilities, how do you turn it back? How do you make these things begin to disappear? Because once enacted, they're part of a giant global secrecy that surrounds this whole thing.
I would begin in the Constitution by including a definition of what constitutes a national emergency. For example, I think we could all agree that military action against the United States or a terrorist attack on par with, say, September 11th would certainly constitute a national emergency.
It would.
Maybe a catastrophic national event like a magnitude 8 earthquake in California, something of this nature, which clearly would demand quick, sudden, and decisive action to save lives. Yes, that's quite clear. But we've had national emergencies declared for such things as the trade balance of payments being out of kilter, or to protect snail darters, or for some other very minute, almost irrelevant reasons. We need to tighten up on that considerably. We also need to, because when the Constitution was framed, the possibility of the sudden loss of the executive and legislative branches in one day wasn't considered a possibility. We need to include provisions for restoring a constitutional government, electing replacement of members of the legislative and executive branches as soon as possible, and spell that out in the Constitution. Finally, we need to have some clear constitutional restrictions on when and how the military can be used in civilian law enforcement, because that is perhaps the most odious and potentially dangerous aspect of the shadow government.
Harry, how close do you think we've been to the invocation of these kind of powers? Have we come that close?
It is known that on certain occasions, such as the Los Angeles riots of 1992.
Yep.
We were very close to that. In fact, some military units were used in the latter stages of those riots. It's known that there was a partial activation of shadow government on September 11, 2001, when Vice President Cheney was taken on that day from Washington to Mount Weather, a large underground facility in Western Virginia, which if the shadow government has a capital, that's it.
That's it, huh? Do you think, Harry, that it's possible that a state of emergency could be declared and that the problem or emergency could be handled and then we would just simply slide back into constitutional government? Or do you think that there is a substantial chance all of this has grown so dire that once we cross that bridge, we well might not come back?
I would ask the question, how many times has government ever received an increase in its power or its ability to impact our lives and has ever voluntarily returned such power to the people? The answer is very seldom.
Very rarely, yes. Very rarely. So it would be your view then that if we really went off the cliff with this and began to invoke the really serious aspects of this, Harry, that we might not come back?
I could see us lapsing to a state of this permanent national emergency leading to a permanent curtailment of certain key rights, particularly those relating to freedom of expression, assembly, property ownership rights, and those sorts of things.
Those are some pretty serious rights you're talking about, Bridget.
Very fundamental rights, and the rights that make us America in the first place. And that's why I say we have to be careful that we're not trying to, with our efforts to protect ourselves, we wind up destroying the very fabric of this nation.
Would Mount Weather be the capital of the new shadow government should it all come cascading down?
Mount Weather is an underground facility originally built to withstand a direct hit from a Soviet ICBM that can support up to 1,000 people for 30 days totally cut off from the outside world. Mm-hmm. Above it, you have the FEMA Training Center, which conducts training exercises for regional FEMA personnel and exercises. And it is, in effect, this place that in event of a really catastrophic national emergency, such as a nuclear strike or an actual or impending terrorist attack with weapons of mass destruction, this is where essential civilian leaders would go, along with some military support staff, to basically run the government from with underground.
Well, so is that a yes?
Yes.
Okay. And I presume then that the broadcast industry, those radio stations that I'm speaking on right now, would be singing a new tune, one that would be coming from Mount Weather.
Mount Weather has complete radio and TV production facilities within it.
Does it really?
Yes, indeed.
Would all of this be accomplished through the use of the emergency action
emergency broadcast system?
Yes.
That
well, it used to be called that. I think it's got a new name now, actually.
That is what that would, in a national emergency, yes, that's what it would be. That is what all stations would be broadcasting the feed that it got from there.
All right. Hold it right there. You know, for most Americans, it's impossible to almost even contemplate that such an un-American, anti-constitutional thing could ever be done by anybody, president or otherwise. Most of us just can't believe it can occur. But, hey, you know, look around the world at what has happened elsewhere and ask yourself...